Sponsored No Holds Barred Talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
To another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. This is the Thursday night edition of the broadcast, February 16th, 2012, now into Friday, February 17th, 2012. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight for another late night. It is late night show tonight. We've been starting around the 12 o'clock hour, a little thereafter lately, but tonight I almost wasn't going to do a show tonight because there just wasn't a lot of material. We're sort of in that, we're in this phase where everything is absolute propaganda, or everything is absolute fear-mongering propaganda from, you know, alternative media. So, or we already had one day this week where there wasn't anything show worthy. So, I thought instead of not doing a show at all, I'd just, you know, push the show back a little later tonight, play some music, and come up here with what I got and see what we got going on. So thanks for being with us. And I people appreciate shows regardless of their length sometimes. And, you know, sometimes the shows where you don't think that you're going to have a lot to cover sometimes turn into, you know, end up getting on all kinds of tangents. So we'll see what happens here tonight. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. It's theglobalreality.com. Everything pertaining to the work that I'm trying to do here can be found up there on the website. For everything from the news, all the news we talk about here on a daily basis gets put up there by Manhadra, our webmaster. So go and check out the news there. Of course, the stream links to listen to the stream. You can always hear rebroadcasts and marathons on the weekend of the week shows and all kinds of different stuff. Archives of past shows, of course, documentaries up there. You can buy Secret Right Volume 2, my newest film on Blu-ray and DVD up there. Video clips, audiobooks, and all kinds of stuff. Chat room, et cetera, up there. And theglobalreality.com. And that's how you support our work as well. The Chip and Bear on the donate button. You're not going to sit in my lap right now. Fuck off. I don't have time to play with you right now. Damn cat. So if you have emails you'd like to send in tonight as well during the show, globalrealityshow@gmail.com. That's globalrealityshow@gmail.com. I wasn't going to come on air tonight. There just wasn't a lot of stuff, but then I was like, I'll just push it back a little later and still go on, you know. I mean, why not? Fuck it. Even if it's shorter than, but you know, the thing about it is the couple of shows that we did, especially Monday show, but the two shows I've done this week have been, you know, maybe a little longer anyway. That's kind of why I think I really shot my load on Monday. It's kind of, the show was almost 3 hours Monday, and Tuesday it was like there was, you know, I had nothing left really. So there wasn't really a lot in the news that day. But we do have a few things here tonight to talk about. We'll also be reading our continued series of reading from Zechariah Sitchin's The End of Days. That'll be getting into some of the more interesting stuff. It is getting more and more interesting. That's the great thing about this stuff. And, you know, I just you know, as I've said many times, I'm not reading this stuff as a, you know, as a full endorsement of his work at all, but regardless of whether or not, the research is flawless, and obviously it is not, but the fact of the matter is it's our responsibility, if we're going to call ourselves researchers, to look at the research that has been done, whether or not that research may consist of, you know, disinformation and bad information and misinformation, et cetera, et cetera. We still have a responsibility to take the work that is there and try to put the pieces together ourselves and find out what's been left out and then put that out there to the masses. I mean, that's what I feel like I do here, and that's what we're supposed to do. So that's why I read these books on air, and, you know, because I just, for my first real reasoning for doing it was because everybody always wants, there's this, and this is a part of the operation with Zachariah Sitchin, is that what they've done is they've created this thing where if you talk about, you know, Sumerians or the Anunnaki or anything else, they automatically throw the baby out with the bathwater and automatically bring up Sitchin every time when from my research, the scholarly translations of the Sumerian tablets are almost identical to what you see in the Sitchin translations. But at the same time, you know, I don't buy into this whole Nibiru is a planet thing. I mean, he just, as we've covered already in our reading, he backtracks and then tries to repeatedly reinforce this idea of Nibiru as a planet when it was already established that Nibiru is Marduk or Ra, and this return would symbolize him returning in, you know, some massive spaceship or something of that nature, when an alignment between the Earth and this other planetary system happens on a time scale and which allows these portals, wormholes, stargates to be opened up, which allows the transference from heaven to earth, as they talk about in the Sumerian text. So, you know, I my reasoning behind reading this stuff is because, you know, for years and years and years, it's just shit talk this, shit talk that on Sitchin and the whole thing, instead of saying, okay, well, you know, have you read his works? Is yourself, you know, tell me where he's lying to us here. Nobody ever seemed to be able to do that. So I thought, why not read these things? And we can decide for ourselves upon reading them based on our current research, our current knowledge, what we think is legit and what we think is fiction. And I, from my opinion, my honest personal opinion from all the Sitchin stuff that we've read here on the show so far is that there's a big mix of both. I think he provides a big mixture of both. If you've got discernment and you research this stuff on your own like I have, it's a lot easier to be able to delineate and be able to tell in which cases he's giving you the real dirt and stuff that's, you know, verifiable and backed up, and stuff that he's, you know, for whatever reason, either theorizing on or speculating on or you know, just making up, maybe in some cases, just out of the clear blue sky, I think. Yeah. But, you know, we have to become our own strong, researchers. And I think that this kind of material challenges us to do that. And, I think that's one of the biggest problems, is people just rely on talking heads and people like me and other people out there to provide the information to you. And I, you know, I have never claimed to ever be able to do that, ever will. I simply get up here and with what I do, try to transmit to you the things that I'm finding in my own quest for this knowledge. And as we've seen in many other things throughout history and throughout any many trades and whatever have you, that's, you know, that's sometimes all people need to be able to start doing something themselves, is to see one other person doing it, you know? But absolutely, I think that in all the Sitchin stuff that we've read here so far, I've seen a good mixture of stuff that I know to be factual and backed up, and then I see a lot of stuff that also I don't agree with at all. But again, it preys on the problem with it is that it preys on people who won't spend hours and days and weeks and months and years and decades, literally, of their lives researching this stuff to even be able to discern, you know, what is the real and what is the fiction. When you're looking at Zachariah Sitchin, that should be a line in a song. How do you determine the fiction? That's a pretty good rhyme there. But I think that that's to me is what we all are supposed to be doing is, you know, don't just believe somebody. If somebody tells you, you know, Zachariah Sitchin is, you know, the bomb and is, oh, that's the truth. Be skeptical of that and look into it for yourself. If somebody tells you, oh, Zachariah Sitchin's disinfo and horseshit and blah, 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 don't just believe that either. Look into it for yourself. And I saw a lot of people saying those things on both sides, but I didn't see a lot of people ever presenting information to back up either side, pro or con. Not enough to convince me otherwise. So I said, you know what? I'm going to be honest. I've read more of the, when I had read The Lost Book of Enki, I had never read one single Zachariah Sitchin book in my entire life up to that point. And also all the stuff that I knew about those kind of things came from stuff that I had found on my own research that weren't Zachariah Sitchin as the source. So I have a pretty good nose of going when I go through his stuff, just because I have a history of researching that stuff before ever seeing his work. So for me, I feel like I have a filter there, which allows me to be able to sort out the good from the bad, so to speak. But I think that not finding out for yourself the validity of something and just believing, I mean, that's so dangerous, and that's what they count on. That's why they allowed this phony 9/11 truth movement crap to pop up. You know, the 9/11 truth movement never successfully got out any real or true information. Anytime you start trying to dig too deep, you know, they start trying to wrangle you back in on the plantation, man. That was one of the reasons why I left the 9/11 truth movement. I saw some crap from people that were into these groups that was just disgusting to me. Borderlining on the criminal, you know. I that's when I was like, okay, well, I got to do something bigger than this. This was back in 2007. And I was like, I've got to take this to another level somehow. So I just come out 9/11 New World Rising, and I knew some different talk show hosts that were on air at that time, and they wanted to have me on. One of those was Mike Chambers. And him and a couple other hosts that were on at that time had me on and stuff about the film. And eventually somebody that used to do a show had went out of town, and they asked me to sit in for them while they were out of town. So I'd never done a radio show before, never really thought about it. So they asked me to sit in for him for a couple of shows. So first time I ever went on air, I didn't know what to do. So I just like, fuck it. I sent Freeman a message, and I was like, hey, Freeman, I'm doing a radio show. I've never done a fucking radio show in my whole life. You want to come be the guest on my first radio show, my first time ever on air? I'm not going to promise you it's not going to suck, but it'd probably be fun because we can talk about whatever we want. He was like, I'm down. So Freeman came on. So the very first ever Global Reality Show it wasn't even a Global Reality Show yet. It was just me on somebody else's show with Freeman for like 2 hours. back in 2007, and then not too long after that, I guess people liked what I talked about and stuff. So people had asked if I could get my own show, and then I did get my own show. A show after that, Mike Chambers gave me a show on his network that he was running at that time, TruthNet Radio. That's where me and Lee Rogers and Doug Owen and Rob Chowder and Joel Bissett and Oh, who else? Oh, my Michael Vail. All of us all started over there at TrueNet Radio back in 2007. But, you know, it's just amazing that, you know, sometimes careful what you wish for. I wanted to start trying to change things on a big level and get information out to people on a big level. And, boy, that's really started to happen now with these different films and just the interest in it. You know, like I've said a million times, if our support financially ever catches up to, the support we have now from listeners and stuff, man, we will be doing pretty good. We'll be changing some things. And that's the only thing that ever holds us back. That's why I get so frustrated, because, you know, if we didn't have to worry about, the cost of running the operation every month and making films, boy, we'd be doing okay. We'd be really whooping some ass that way. But, you know, that's the whole thing, is that, all you have to do is just make the effort to try and get involved somehow, some way. You know, some people do have the ability to start their own radio show or start doing, you know, videos on YouTube and stuff. And that's great. And those people should do that. And other people don't have the ability to do that. And, you know, the only way they can do that, they can get involved, is to support my work or something like that, you know, and that's fine. It's just, the whole thing is that, it just, you have to do something and not be attached to the outcome. You know, that's the most important thing. And that's one of the things that we're programmed, is to constantly be attached to the reward or the outcome of whatever our particular action is going to be. And I was not free of that. Everything I had ever done in my life up to the point of when I started doing this had been, you know, that way, you know, the want of the end reward, you know, whether that was music and, you know, trying to get a record deal or something, or whether that was working at, working for a software company I used to work for and, you know, trying to climb the ladder there and get promotions and stuff. So I just, you know, it was the first thing I'd ever done when I started doing this that wasn't, where I wasn't, the only outcome I was attached to was the possibility of, you know, a large amount of people who need this type of information that we talk about here on this show not getting it. And that was it. That was my only motivation. You know, that was all I needed. And, you know, I like I said, lo and behold, there, you know, just a couple of days, first week of shows that I do, here comes Peter Dale Scott, and he drops the CMP stuff right in my lap, and, you know, the rest is history. But, I mean, I can't tell you how consciousness shifting it is and paradigm shifting it is, you know, aside from the information itself, but how paradigm shifting it is to, you know, to do something and not be attached to the outcome or the benefit of it. And yeah, it's tough and it's difficult, but the reward is that, you know, things that you never would have experienced otherwise when you were just trying to do things for your own personal gain or your own personal, you know, material wants and all this other stuff. When you're doing something strictly because it's the right thing to do and it needs to be done, yeah, it's hard and it's difficult. And, you know, I scrape by here, but I'm doing something. And I could not live with myself knowing the things that I know without doing something. And, you know, I can't, this is all I can do. You know, I can make films pretty good. I can do some pretty good radio shows. I can research the hell out of some information. I have the ability to retain lots of data in my brain and total recall at any given moment. And, you know, so that's what I'm trying to do. And I think that's what every single person has to do. You know, you can't do things exactly how I'm doing them, and I can't do things exactly how somebody else is doing them. You know, we all have to find our own ways, but I think that the most important thing is that you know, you have to have a want and a thirst for knowledge. I just don't see what, you know, what was it? $1.2 million, however much money that went to Ron Paul on Valentine's Day for this money bomb. I just don't know how the flag waving hysteria and the mania around Ron Paul in the election, I just don't know what that has to do with personal knowledge and enlightenment and the quest for the real truth. And that's what, you know, that's what the secret right is. That's the question the secret right is asking. My films. That's the question the secret right volume 2 is asking. You know? What does this, you know, mania over left-right politics, and it's just so disgusting to see Alex Jones sit there and say, I don't believe in the left-right paradigm, folks, but vote for Ron Paul. No, that's a lie. That's a contradiction. That's Orwellian, you fucking dumbass. You if you say that you don't believe in the false left-right paradigm, that would mean that you would never support that or a candidate or anybody involved in it. We make an exception when it comes to Ron Paul. Well, you're a hypocrite and a liar. But none of that stuff, none of that, you know, let's get our guy in there. So what does that have to do with the truth? What does it have to do with us gaining the knowledge that we've been kept in the dark about so we can turn things around for ourselves on the planet? Nothing. And that's what Alex Jones and the whole Patriot movement and all that is designed to do. Absolutely nothing. The only way we're going to change things is if we continue to dig and continue to quest for our own personal knowledge and the knowledge we're being kept in the dark about by the powers that be. But we get sidetracked by this fear-mongering. We get sidetracked by the end of the world hysteria. We get sidetracked by wars and rumors of wars and the drum beating going on there. So we stay in a mass panic and hysteria, and then they create this artificial downturn in the economy, this artificial economic disaster, which is, you know, very easy to do when you control the whole game. It's very easy to make disasters and boom and bust economies on a whim. You guys ever wonder why two of the biggest board games that have ever been in homes all over the world, two of the biggest board games of all time are Monopoly and Risk? You ever see the irony there? I mean, they laid it all out for us right there, and by putting those games in every one of our homes. Because, you know, what is the goal of Monopoly? Is the goal of Monopoly to everybody has wealth and everybody spreads it around and everybody sitting at the game board, you know, has lots of hotels and lots of houses and lots of money in their bank? No, fuck no. It's slash and burn, baby. Cutthroat. You'll sell your own fucking mother out for Park Avenue if you're sitting at the goddamn table. It's winner take all. Cut, slash, and burn. You're not sitting around going, oh, hey, well, Mom, I see you don't have enough money to put another hotel on Park Place here. Let me help you out and give you a little some of my funny money out of my little bank here. Hell no, it's not. No, it's cutthroat, man. And so, you know, to expect that the real world system would be any different from that is you're living in a fantasy world. Risk the same way. Look at that. I mean, my God, it's a joke to these people. And it's been right there in front of our face all this time. We've been too blind to see it. Thanks for being with us here tonight. Let's get into some news. Let's see what we have here to get into. FEMA wants to monitor news coverage of its activities nationwide 24/7. Now, why would they be interested in doing that? But this is starting to sound like the X-Files, isn't it? Remember in the X-Files, FEMA takes over when the alien invasion's about to happen in 2012? Secret government. Well, now they want to track 24/7 any and all transmissions of any in all news activity, alternative news, I'm sure included in this, which discuss and talk about FEMA. This is, I mean, this is beyond total information awareness. FEMA is planning to award a 100% small business set-aside contract to a media monitoring firm that can monitor, archive, and measure all local news in major Nielsen markets, all nationally broadcast news, and all cable outlets for their news coverage of FEMA activities in the field across the U.S. And now they already have, you know, control of the emergency broadcast system. That's what going from analog signals to digital signals is all about. In the event of an emergency or the event of a false flag or the event of a staged alien invasion or whatever it may be, when it was all analog, you can hijack an analog signal. You can get in there and put a rogue signal up and people can pick it up. You can get on there and say, hey, don't believe this shit. They're lying to you. They're really aliens, you know, whatever. I'm just making analogies here. But when they went to now that they've gone to the digital broadcast boxes, maybe those are encrypted. You're not just going to put yourself up a little antenna and start broadcasting. No. They have it all locked down now. And that's what this is about. The monitoring service will be expected to provide media statistics, including the audience exposure and publicity value for that news coverage. They're worried about their publicity value? You know, these guys couldn't fix a hole in a bucket if you glued it together for them. And that's because people think, oh, yeah, well, FEMA, they're blah, 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 this or whatever. They're incompetent. No, they're not incompetent. Nobody's being incompetent for just because they're incompetent. They're being incompetent because they're not being paid to be competent. They're not paid to fix anything or help anybody. The government's going to help you. I mean, it's just unbelievable now. But yeah, this is part of the total information lockdown. This is scary. First case of Legionnaire's disease. Legionnaire's disease. Jesus Christ. This is the Dark Ages. First case of Legionnaire's disease found at a dentist. Doctors on Friday reported the first known case of Legionnaire's disease, a rare infection usually linked to a faulty air conditioning and hot water systems that was caused by a visit to the dentist. The case report published in Lancet describes an unnamed 82-year-old woman in Rome who was hospitalized with fever and breathing problems in February 2011. Swiftly diagnosed with infection by the Legionella pneumonia, it's not pneumonia, but it's like, oh, pneumophilia germ, yeah, pneumophilia germ. Legionella pneumophilia germ, she died 2 days later of septic shock despite being given heavy doses of antibiotics. During the 2 to 10 day time it would have taken for the bacteria to incubate, the patient had only left her house twice, both times to attend appointments at the dentist. Samples of water were taken from the dentist's tap, from the water line, the tube that supplies water to tooth scalers and handpieces used by the dentist, and from high-pressure pumps supplying the water line itself. All three sources tested positive for the L. pneumophilia, but especially in water taken from the pump. So that's interesting. I mean, Legionnaire's disease. I don't really know much about it, but I know that people have had symptoms of it from, barium poisoning, chemtrail-type stuff. So it does make you wonder if there's a connection possibly to, my God, man, you know, this chemtrail stuff gets in all the water supplies. Some of this stuff is so microscopic when it breaks down that the filters don't get it out anyway. So it's going into the water supply. It's going into food supply, everything. I don't know if you guys have noticed this over the past, 6, 7, 8 years or so. Power supplies on computers go out very quickly, a lot quicker than they used to. And supposedly the reason that is because there's a, and if you ever are dusting off your fans inside your computer, make sure you wear a mask or something, or put a scarf or a bandana around your mouth, your nose, whenever you're cleaning out the dust from your computers and stuff like that. You do not want to breathe any of that stuff in, because what happens is a lot of the stuff that's in the air from the chemtrails and stuff, it builds up in there and it gets like super, super concentrated. And it'll stick to your fans and stuff. And you breathe that stuff in, it's bad news. You can get sick from it. Who knows what else? But there's something in these in the stuff that's in the air from the chemtrails that causes power supplies on computer systems to go out in a lot shorter amount of a time than they should. But that's wild stuff though. This is, and speaking of wild stuff, metal swarm. Harvard experts create tiny robot bees that pop up out of sheets of metal and carbon fiber. You thought the robot swarm that came out a couple of weeks ago was insane. Well, this is even crazier here. I'll drop a link to this for you in the chat room. God damn. So this is like, you know, this just pops up, manifests itself out of carbon fiber. Harvard scientists have invented a method of mass-producing robot insects, creating sheets of tiny robot bees that pop up ready for action. When activated, a 2.4-millimeter-tall robot insect pops up out of the sheet. The scientists say that they aim to create swarms of independently flying robots. I mean, welcome to the machines, baby. The entire product is approximately the size of a U.S. quarter, and dozens of microbots could pop up out of a single sheet. This is crazy. The scientists say they were inspired by origami and pop-up books. The sheet consists of carbon fiber, plastic film, titanium, brass, and ceramic, laser cut into a sheet. They are assembled by robots and can be mass-produced rapidly. The 18-layer structure incorporates flexible hinges that allow the three-dimensional product, just 2.4 millimeters tall, to assemble in one movement like a pop-up book. The Harvard Microbiotics Laboratory has been working for years to build bio-inspired bee-sized robots that can fly and behave autonomously as a colony. Why have you been working for years to build that? Seriously, can we please ask that question? What is the possible gain for mankind, for planet Earth, for the world in general, to, quote, spend years working to build bio-inspired bee-sized robots that can fly and behave autonomously as a colony? Why do we need to have robot bees as a colony? Why is that important? Why are we going to spend years and millions of dollars working to build that? Do you ever get the feeling that, you know, the answer to that question might be because the Matrix is being built around us right now as we speak, but most of us are too blind to even see it? I mean, in my opinion, the evidence points in that direction. I mean, I'm not kidding. I think they're building this fucking technological enslavement grid all around us, the actual real-life matrix, and we just think it's progress. We can generate full systems in any three-dimensional shape. I mean, these can be chink, crank, chink, chink. Crank these out fast, put weapon systems, little darts on them. They can fly around. They can wipe out millions of people in large populated areas in a short amount of time, and just send in the drones, baby. That's all you got to do. Swarms of them. Unfucking believable. It really is. Was Stonehenge the result of an extraordinary hallucination after frenzied flute playing? Holy fucking Christ. Boy, that's a question I wake up every single morning asking myself and have for quite some time. I'm glad somebody besides me was crazy enough to ask that fucking question. I mean, don't you get up every morning and ask yourself, you know, why was Stonehenge the result of an extraordinary hallucination after frenzied flute playing? Frenzied flute playing after an extraordinary hallucination was what Stonehenge was the result of. So okay, I guess this was stone people playing flute, And they just got stoned and were tripping balls and threw some rocks up there and made them line up. This wasn't done by the order of the Druids, and this doesn't go back, you know, thousands of years now. Its iconic stones are said to mark an ancient burial site, for form an astronomical calendar, or even be a monument to the fertility gods. But no one has claimed Stonehenge to be the result of a trick of the mind until now. A major science conference heard yesterday that the blueprint for the mystical stone circle came from otherworldly visions triggered by music. While the theory may seem outlandish, legend has it that some stone circles were formed when maidens who danced in a circle to magical pipers were turned to stone. Yeah. Yeah. Maidens who dance in a circle to magical pipers playing the fucking skin flute on the summer solstice. That's what they were doing. The intriguing idea comes from Steve Waller, an independent scientist who believes art and architecture are inspired not only by what we see, but also what we hear. He is particularly interested in the effect of something called an interference pattern, the variation in sound created when two noises collide. Depending on how they interact, sections of the sound can be dampened. The effect can confuse the brain, tricking it into thinking that there is a building or other structure in the way, blocking the sound. The American Association for the Advancement of Science annual conference in Vancouver heard, "The first experiment ran by Dr. Waller demonstrated this and tied it to Stonehenge and other stone circles. He took two groups of volunteers, blindfolded them, and led them in a circle around a pair of recorders that were being played. They were then asked to turn away, take off their blindfolds, and sketch what they thought had been between them and the noise. Drawings and descriptions included circles of pillars, solid objects, openings, archways, and tall vertical slats." Dr. Waller said, "I believe that could have happened 5,000 years ago just as easily as it can be demonstrated today. That if these people in the past were dancing in a circle around two people playing the flute or whistle or whatever they had back then, and they were experiencing the loud and soft regions that happen when an interference pattern is set up, they would have felt that there were these massive objects arranged in a ring. It would have been a completely baffling experience they would have not been able to explain. Anything that was mysterious like that in the past was considered to be magical and supernatural. And I think that was what it motivated them to build the actual structure that matched this impression. It was like a vision they received from another world." Yeah, could be. I don't know. That's interesting, though. But I think there is a precedent for, you know, the involvement of sound and frequency. I mean, allegedly, that's what a lot of these ancient stone monuments, that's how these stones were cut, you know, using these frequencies from the spoken word that can be used to, you know, cut solid rock and everything else. Man, this is some disgusting news right here. Private prisons corporation offers cash in exchange for state prisons. Now listen to this. As state governments wrestle with massive budget shortfalls, a Wall Street giant is offering a solution. Cash in exchange for state property. Prisons, to be exact. So this Wall Street giant that owns all these prisons wants to buy up state prisons, and what they want in exchange for that, they're going to want to give cash to the states. Corrections Corporation of America, the nation's largest operator of for-profit prisons, has sent letters recently to 48 states offering to buy up their prisons as a remedy for challenging corrections budgets. In exchange, the company is asking for a 20-year management contract. That means they would run it for 20 years, plus an assurance that the prison would remain at least 90% full. So let me get this straight. They want to buy out all the states' prisons from this, you know, phony economic collapse that they've created, which sets the precedent for them to do this. And in the contract, after they buy out the states and flash all this money around, the state has to maintain its end of the deal during that 20-year period, that it will make sure that it will enact laws and use that money to hire law enforcement to ensure that those prison levels stay at a 90% full level. This is absolutely criminal, folks. I mean, you thought it was bad now. You ain't seen nothing yet. This is just the tip of the police state iceberg. If this goes through, and it probably will. Man, oh man, oh man. Pat Buchanan fired from MSNBC, saying he's been blacklisted, saying that they believe he's a white supremacist. Well, I mean, my God, he's been outed as, you know, going to these same white supremacist meetings as Ron Paul. I've been blacklisted. Blah, 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 blah. No, Pat, you're an operator. You're a Knights of Malta. You're a Jesuit trained. And your stooge activities of being banned and being fired from MSNBC are there to create more divide and conquer and to get the hard right more enraged that the lefty commies are taking over. I mean, you know, neo-McCarthyism. McCarthyism is alive and well in 2012. That's for goddamn sure. Food police reject preschoolers' homemade lunch in favor of chicken nuggets. This is quality right here. A preschool girl was told her homemade meal was not healthy enough, so a school cafeteria monitor made her eat chicken nuggets instead. What? Oh, man. Whew. Oh, God damn. In Texas, that would get a teacher or somebody like that an ass whooping. You know, especially if somebody, you know, was to make. I mean, when if you make food for your kid, you know, to take to school, you know, what's not healthy about a turkey and cheese sandwich, but chicken nuggets are healthy. My God. So now if you bring something, you allow your kids to take something healthy to school, they're probably going to, that's not healthy. Here, you got to eat this fried rat turd. This is healthy. Fried rat turd dipped in ranch dressing. Are you an idiot? How the hell do you live with yourself? How do your parents raise you? Telling you that a ham or a turkey sandwich on wheat bread is more healthier than a fried rat turd dipped in ranch. Fried rat turd dipped in ranch is more healthy for you than that. You eat that instead. Jesus Christ. I mean, they want every... And now I hear that in Chicago, which, by the way, was named most corrupt city in the United States recently. Not a real surprise there, but just to show you how really corrupt it is, out here in Chicago now, in some of the schools, they're actually charging kids, and in the year they've been doing this, so they've already racked up like $188,000 from doing this. They're charging kids a $5 fee every time they get a detention. So this is great. They're already instilling this and programming kids with the, you know, getting used to being robbed at every turn. You know, they used to at least wait until you turned 18 and then they'd start, you know, instigating ways to rob you at every turn. But now they want to make sure that at a very young age, because I mean, my God, that's all law enforcement is. It's a goddamn money trap. That's all it is. It's a way to suck you dry, make you poor, make you never be able to get ahead. So you stay downtrodden and you never become a threat to the power structure. That's what it's about. And they want to start instilling this stuff in kids early. I mean, it's absolutely $188,000 one school made in like 1 year of doing this. Absolutely disgusting. Rick Santorum now says that being female is a mental disorder. Somebody needs to get Dave Mustaine on the horn and ask him if he agrees, since he's now endorsed Rick Santorum. So is that what you believe, Dave? Because I think there'd probably be a lot of people who, up to this point, probably like Megadeth, who probably not going to like him anymore. Here's what Rick Santorum has to say. Here's his quote. It has been my experience that when dealing with females, you need to treat them as though they have a mental disorder, especially those that are constantly seeking equality in the workplace, the military, and in the home. Women need to know their place, and they need to know when it is okay for them to speak. They were put on this earth for two reasons, and two reasons alone. Taking care of their husband and giving birth to his children. That is all. Any woman who tells you otherwise is obviously touting the liberal agenda of equality, and they need to be told the truth of their purpose. It is a disorder that can be fixed, but not until they go through several years of therapy or understand that they need to be subservient. And it's just like they did last time, folks, with McCain. They always do this for whatever side that they want to win at that particular time, whether it be Republicans or Democrats. They always make sure whoever the other guy is, nobody in their right mind would vote for the for that candidate, so they get the candidate they want. Same thing's going to happen again. Obama's going to get voted in again. You're probably going to see Civil War stuff break out. The Ron Paul flunkies are going to go crazy saying he got robbed, and they're going to want to riot. Somebody in a 9/11 Truth We Are Change shirt's going to probably try to shoot Obama or something. I mean, it's going to get wild, but my goodness. So, I don't know. I mean, ladies, I think everybody out there needs to be asking that of Dave Mustaine as well. Cause I think there are a lot of Megadeth fans out there that probably wouldn't agree. I mean, he's currently on tour with a band that has a female singer. So, does Dave believe that, that female singer shouldn't be out there singing, being in a band and being on the road? She should be subservient and be making babies and taking care of her man. It's just the hypocrisy that goes around in these fucking assholes who think they're holier than thou. It just, God damn, makes me sick. This is from Wire. This is a real interesting article here. I'll drop it in the chat room for you. See for yourself the Pentagon's $51 billion black budget. The military keeps a lot of things secret. It could be the exact range of a jammer, sensitive missile data, or the timing of a raid. But the larger context that jammers and missiles exist or that our forces conduct raids is unclassified and even listed in the Pentagon's budget for all to see. These secrets are different. Their names are obscured by code words or simply listed as classified programs. But with a little digging, we can get a limited sense of how much money is being spent on the U.S. government's most secret military projects. In fact, you can take a look for yourself. We've put together this spreadsheet with the latest information, free to add and subtract and edit it, kind of like a classified cash wiki. This year, the military's black budget appears to be a little over $51 billion, down from the $56 billion which had held steady for the last 2 years, not including inflation. These reductions are also not really a surprise considering the cuts happening nearly everywhere else. Because it is not easy saying we have the complete number, the Pentagon likes to play a little hide and seek with its black budget. Projects with code names like the Navy's Retract Juniper and Link Plumeria are simple enough to find in the research development, testing, and evaluation budget, as are many of the Army's tractor projects, tractor nail, tractor cage, and so on. But then comes along a project like Tractor Desk, hiding in one of the Army's 8 research budget documents, while others find their way to the operations and maintenance and procurement budgets. These projects are also where to go when searching what's getting cut. Something called the Classified Program, USDP, formerly valued around a respectable $100 million, had its budget reduced to zero. Tractor Jute is on life support, and Cobra Judy has had the steam taken out of it. Most other projects saw lesser cuts, however, and others like Retract Maple even saw minor gains. This is also why the researcher at DARPA only received a slight trim. The Pentagon budget also sheds light on the shadowy world of special operations forces and their new normal requirements in Afghanistan and other locations like the Horn of Africa. According to SOCOM's operation and maintenance budget, an estimated 11,500 special forces personnel are expected to be in Afghanistan next year, a drop from 12,321 or so commandos financed for this year. SOCOM Southern Command is getting a $796 million shave, but some budget wizardry should make up the difference, according to the budget. $889 million was shuffled from SOCOM's overseas spending to baseline budgets with titles like contract services and contractor logistics support. Yet the overall amount of troops and missions within Afghanistan are projected to increase. It says this means the special forces will require additional resources to reposition personnel and equipment, as well as increase the number of missions executed. Well, yeah, what they're really doing over there is a total secret. I think it's interesting. They're, you know, they're big budget places that they're doing these secret operations, happen to be around the Horn of Africa and in Afghanistan. I mean, those are pretty key, important places there, folks. You know, I think there's definitely something deeper here. The reason why that's where all these big, this big budget and finance is going to. But yeah, it's an interesting story there. There is no evidence that controversial fracking technique used to extract natural gas trapped in rocks beneath the ground pollutes drinking water, scientists said last night. Well, I'm glad they cleared that up for us. I guess all that footage of people lighting their tap water on fire is a lie. I guess all the, those people who died from their water well being contaminated is just a lie. Supports of hydraulic fracturing saying that the exploiting the natural resources would cut energy costs and create new jobs. Shale gas accounts for almost a quarter of natural gas supply in the U.S. They don't offer any information here, no data. It just goes on and talks about what fracking is. The scientists did not address the potential to cause earthquakes, but a recent British report blamed the technique for tremors that hit the Blackpool area last year. No data or information as to or proof as to why it doesn't pollute drinking water. They just say it doesn't. So, you know, that means, hey, you're supposed to believe it doesn't. This is interesting. I've gotten a couple of emails about this over the past several days. I don't really know quite what to think about it, other than it could tie into what I've talked about with this, you know, because I think Nibiru is a red herring. I think this other planet, Vulcan, that's supposedly on the other side of Venus, on the other side of the sun, that usually comes around Earth around 2013 or so and is said to cause earthquakes and cataclysms, that kind of thing. I think that it's making a move towards us, and that's what's causing these effects on Venus. It could be also that you know, we've possibly terraformed Venus, so the atmosphere is shifting. I don't know, but I do know that a couple of years ago, Japan sent up this spaceship called the Icarus spaceship. It was supposed to fly to Mars. And then after it went by Mars, it was supposed to shoot around to the other side of the sun and do some monitoring over there, exactly in this place where this alleged planet Vulcan is supposed to be. And, you know, then you find out that Icarus is the son of Vulcan in Greek mythology, and you go, well, that just can't be a coincidence. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people are saying that that this is happening because of Nibiru, but it's interesting nonetheless. Venus shifts gears. Scientists puzzle as planet is found to be spinning slower than it should. The Venus Express spacecraft has peered through the crushing and poisonous atmosphere of the planet and found that it's spinning slower than expected. Using the Orbitus Vertus spectrograph at infrared wavelengths to penetrate the thick cloud cover, scientists studied surface features and discovered that some are more than 10 miles from where they should be. The length of a Venus day is 6.5 minutes shorter than previously thought. The discovery could help scientists understand the forces at work on the hostile planet and the missions to its surface, and plan missions to its surface. These detailed measurements from our orbit are helping scientists determine whether Venus has a solid liquid core, which would help our understanding for the planet's creation and how it evolved. The orbit could be being affected by Venus's dense atmosphere, more than 90 times the pressure of Earth's and high-speed weather systems. But, you know, I mean, the most likely culprit is you know, our sun itself. And so it's, you know, we're starting to see this changes in, you know, and starting to see effects on planets in our solar system. But we're oblivious to it down here. We're just telling ourselves, oh, you know, the sun doesn't have anything to do with this. I think that movie with Nicolas Cage, Knowing, was right. I think that, you know, I think that's one of the, you know, there's a lot more going on with our sun that these people know about that they're not telling us. What all that is, you know, I don't know, but could it possibly be that our sun's a lot older than they're telling us it is? Maybe. I don't know. Just have to keep on digging. We're going to take a break, come back, and start reading from End of Days from Zachary Sitchin here tonight on the show, folks. Thanks for being with us. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. We have the chipping banner there. And you can support our work to help us pay the bills for the month. We have we need that exact amount this month to pay the bills. We also have the donate button there. If you want to support our work and our films that way, if you want to help us out to build a budget for the next film or help us build a war chest, because we're kind of sitting low in the bank. So whatever help anybody wants to give out there, that's how you do it. TheGlobalReality.com, chip and banner, donate button. And we also have a P.O. box if you absolutely can't use PayPal. This is The Global Reality right here on The Global Reality Radio Network, folks. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Stay with us.
Sound stars. When I saw you behind the bar, I guess that's the way to keep on smiling where you are. But girl, them eyes as big as stars. Sounds funny when you say my name. It's like you're chewing on a foreign thing. And you won't get to sleep till dawn if it don't rain. It sounds so funny when you say my name.
No holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. We're going to be reading from Zechariah Sitchin's The End of Days in this section of the broadcast tonight, chapter 11, The Day of the Lord. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. And if you have ordered DVDs and they have not been received yet, they are going to be mailed tomorrow. I've been I'm kind of low on funds, so I haven't been able to get to do that, but it's going to be handled tomorrow, so sit tight, they'll be on their way. Yeah, the Yeah, the rock wall thing. Yeah, it's fascinating information. You know, it's definitely something I'm hot on the trail of. There's a lot of information. Like I said, you know, plan on taking it to the national level. I just got to have a budget for this thing, and I got to have some help to do that. So I'm hoping that, you know, some people come along very soon. I got to get going on this thing immediately. So, you know, if there's anybody out there can help us with that, we just need like about a $1,500 initial budget to get going. And that'll be, you know, the first good part of the film. Chapter 11, The End of Days, Zechariah Sitchin, The Day of the Lord. As the last millennia BCE began, the appearance of the sign of the cross was a harbinger of the return. It was also then that a temple to Yahweh in Jerusalem forever linked its sacred site to the course of historic events and to mankind's messianic expectations. The time and the place were no coincidence. The impending return dictated the enshrinement of the erstwhile Mission Control Center. Compared to the mighty and conquering imperial powers of those days, Babylonia, Assyria, Egypt, the Hebrew kingdom was a midget. Compared to the greatness of their capitals, Babylon, Nineveh, Thebes, with their sacred precincts, ziggurats, temples, processional ways, ornate gates, majestic palaces, hanging gardens, sacred pools, and river harbors. Jerusalem was a small city with hastily built walls and an iffy water supply, and yet millennia later, it is Jerusalem, a living city that is in our hearts and in the daily headlines, while the grandeur of other nations' capitals has turned to dust and crumbled ruins. What made the difference? The temple of Yahweh that was built in Jerusalem and its prophets whose oracles came true. Their prophecies, one therefore believes, still hold the key to the future. The Hebrew association with Jerusalem, and in particular with Mount Moriah, goes back to the time of Abraham. It was where he had fulfilled his assignment of protecting the spaceport during the War of the Kings that he was greeted by Melchizedek, the king of Ur-Shalom, Jerusalem, who was the priest of the God Most High. There Abraham was blessed and in turn took an oath by the God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. It was again there when Abraham's devotion was tested that he granted a covenant with God. Yet it took a millennium until the right time and circumstances for the temple to be built. The Bible asserted that the Jerusalem temple was unique, and so indeed it was. It was conceived to preserve the bond of heaven and earth that the Duran Key of Sumer-Nippur had once been. So it was looking to establish itself as a stargate. Thus does the Bible record in the first book of Kings the memorable start of the construction of the Temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem by King Solomon, giving us the exact date of the event. It was a crucial, decisive step whose consequences are still with us. And the time, it must be noted, was when Babylon and Assyria adopted the sign of the cross as the harbinger of the return. So again, you know, the return of the cross, you know, the cross being the sign of the return, or the return of who? The return of Jesus, the return of Marduk, the return of Ra, Quetzalcoatl, Thoth, maybe it's all the same thing. How about that? The dramatic story of the Jerusalem temple starts not with Solomon, but with King David, Solomon's father, and how he happened to become Israel's king is a tale that reveals a divine plan. To prepare for the future by resurrecting the past. David's legacy, a reign of 40 years, included a greatly expanded realm reaching in the far north as far as Damascus and including the landing place. Many magnificent psalms and the groundwork for Yahweh's temple. Three divine emissaries played key roles in the making of this king and his place in history. The Bible lists them as Samuel the seer, Nathan the prophet, and Gad the visionary. It was Samuel, the custodian priest of the Ark of the Covenant, who was instructed by God to take the youth David, son of Jesse, from herding sheep to be shepherd of Israel. And Samuel took the oil-filled horn and anointed him to reign over Israel. The choosing of the young David, who was shepherding his father's flock, to be shepherd over Israel was doubly symbolic, for it harks back to a golden age of Sumer, Its kings were called Lugal, the great man, but they strove to earn the cherished title, NC, the righteous shepherd. That, as we shall see, was only the beginning of David's and the temple's links to the Sumerian past. David began his reign in Hebron, south of Jerusalem, and that too was a choice filled with historic symbolism. The previous name of Hebron, the Bible repeatedly pointed out, was Kiriath Arba, the fortified city of Arba. And who was Arba? He was a great man of the Anakim. Anakim is like the Anunnaki or the Rephaim, or two biblical terms that render in Hebrew the Sumerian Lugal and Anunnaki, starting with the passages in the book of Numbers and then in Joshua, Judges, and Chronicles. The Bible reported that Hebron was a center of the descendants of the Anakim, who as the Nephilim are counted, thus connecting them to the Nephilim of Genesis 6, who intermarried with the daughters of Adam. Hebron was still inhabited at the time of the Exodus by the three sons of Arba. And it was Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who captured the city and slew them in behalf of Joshua. By choosing to be king in Hebron, David established his kingship as a direct continuation of kings linked to the Anunnaki of Sumerian lore. He reigned in Hebron for 7 years and then moved his capital to Jerusalem. His seat of the kingship, the city of David, was built on Mount Zion, just south of and separated by a small valley from Mount Moriah, where the platform built by the Anunnaki was. He constructed the Milo, the filling, to close the gap between the two mounts, as a first step to building on the platform Yahweh's temple. But all he was allowed to erect on Mount Moriah was an altar. God's word through the prophet Nathan was that because David had shed blood in his many wars, not he but his son Solomon would build the temple. Devastated by the prophet's message, David went and sat before Yahweh in front of the Ark of the Covenant, which was still housed in a portable tent. Accepting God's decision, he asked for one reward for his devout loyalty to him: an assurance, a sign that would indeed be the house of David that would build the temple and forever be blessed. That very night, sitting in front of the Ark of the Covenant, by which Moses had communicated with the Lord, he received a divine sign. Oh yeah, I'm just hanging out over here by the Ark of the Covenant, yeah. I'm over here hanging out by it. It's a communication device, dude. Of course you're going to get a sign, please. My God, must be nice. You know, I'm just going to go over and hang out by the Ark of the Covenant. Maybe all my fucking hair will fall out this time. He received a divine sign. He was given a tavenet, a scale model of the future temple. So this thing just manifested a scale model of the temple he's supposed to build in front of him, just out of the Ark of the Covenant, you know, like it does. Yeah, this thing's some kind of computer as well, I think. One can shrug off the tale's veracity were it not for the fact that what happened that night to King David and his temple project was the equivalent of the Twilight Zone tale of the Sumerian king Gudea, who more than 1,000 years earlier was likewise given, in a vision dream, a tablet with the architectural plan in a brick mold for the construction of a temple in Lagash for the god Ninurta. When he neared the end of his days, King David summoned to Jerusalem all the leaders of Israel, including the tribal chiefs and the military commanders, the priests and the royal office holders, and told them of Yahweh's promise, and in full view of those gathered, he handed to his son Solomon the tavenet of the temple and all of its parts and chambers, the tavenet that he received by the Spirit. There was more, for David also handed over to Solomon all that Yahweh in his own hand written, given to me for understanding the workings of the tavenet, a set of accompanying instructions divinely written. The Hebrew term tavenet is translated in the King James English Bible as pattern, but is rendered plan in more recent translations. Now, why would they go from pattern to plan? Those two words could indicate two totally different things. Just another example of the, obfuscations in King James Bible, one of many. This was suggesting that David was given some kind of an architectural drawing. But the Hebrew word for plan is takenet, Cavenant, on the other hand, is derived from the root verb that means to construct, to build, or to erect. So what David was given and what he handed over to his son Solomon was a constructed model, in today's parlance, a scale model. Archaeological finds throughout the ancient Near East have indeed unearthed scale models of chariots, wagons, ships, workshops, and even multi-level shrines. The biblical books of Kings and Chronicles provide precise measurements and clear structural details of the temple and its architectural designs. Its axis ran east-west, making it an eternal temple aligned to the equinox. Consisting of three parts, it adopted the Sumerian temple plans of a four-part, a great central hall, hikal in Hebrew, stemming from the Sumerian egal, or large abode, and a holy of holies for the Ark of the Covenant. That innermost section was called the Devir, the speaker, for it was by means of the Ark of the Covenant that God spoke to Moses. As in Sumerian ziggurats, which traditionally were built to express the sexagesimal base 60 concept, the Temple of Solomon had adopted 60 in its construction. The main section, the hall, was 60 cubits, about 100 feet in length by 20 cubits wide, and 120 cubits in height. The Holy of Holies was 20 by 20 cubits, just enough to hold the Ark of the Covenant with the two golden cherubim atop, their wings touching. Tradition, textual evidence, and archaeological research indicate that the Ark was placed precisely on the extraordinary rock on which Abraham was ready to sacrifice his son Isaac. Its Hebrew designation, even Shetiah, means foundation stone. And Jewish legends hold that it is from that the world will be recreated. Nowadays, it is covered over and surrounded by the Dome of the Rock. Though these were not monumental measurements compared to the skyscraping ziggurats, the temple, when completed, was truly magnificent. It was also unlike any other contemporary temple in that part of the world. No iron or iron tools were used for its erection upon the platform, and absolutely none in its operation. All the utensils were of copper or bronze, and the building was inlaid inside with gold. Even the nails holding the golden plates in place were made of gold. The quantities of gold used for just the Holy of the Holies, 600 talents for the nails, 50 shekels, were enormous, so much so that Solomon arranged for special ships to bring gold from Ophir, which was believed to be in Southeast Africa. The Bible offers no explanation either for the prohibition against using anything made of iron on the site, nor for the inlaying of everything inside the temple with gold. Yeah. Now they're big because they were building it for their, you know, slave masters that wanted gold. That's why it was, they were building it like that. Give me a break. One can only speculate that iron was shunned because of its magnetic properties and gold because it is the best electrical conductor. It is significant that the only two other known instances of shrines so inlaid with gold are on the other side of the world. One is the Great Temple in Cusco, the Inca capital in Peru, where the great god of South America, Viracocha, was worshipped. It was also called, well, Viracocha is also supposedly Inki, or Toth, or Quetzalcoatl. So, you know, yeah, that's what these, what's so significant about these different archaeological sites in different parts of the world. It was called the Coricancha. The golden enclosure for its Holy of Holies was completely inlaid with gold. The other is in Pumapunku on the shores of Lake Titicaca. Wah, Titicaca. Wah. Pumapunku on Lake Titicaca. Some kind of alien, some kind of... The ruins there consist of the remains of four chamber-like stone buildings whose walls, floors, and ceilings were each cut out of a single colossal stone block. The four enclosures were completely inlaid inside with golden plates that were held in place with golden nails. Describing the sites and how they were looted by the Spaniards in lost realms, I have suggested that Pumapunku was erected for the stay of Anu and Antu when they visited the earth circa 4000 BCE. According to the Bible, tens of thousands of workmen were needed for 7 years for the immense undertaking. What then was the purpose of this house of the Lord? When all was ready with much pomp and circumstance, the Ark of the Covenant was carried by priests and placed in the Holy of Holies. As soon as the ark was put down and the curtain separating the Holy of Holies from the great hall were drawn, the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud, and the priests could not remain standing. Then Solomon offered a thanksgiving prayer, saying, Lord, who has chosen to dwell in the cloud, I have built for thee a stately house, a place where you may dwell forever. Though the uttermost heavens cannot contain thee, may you hear our supplications from thine seat in heaven. And Yahweh appeared to Solomon that night and said to him, I have heard your prayer. I have chosen this site for my house of worship. From heaven I will hear the prayers of my people and forgive their transgressions. Now I have chosen and consecrated this house for my Shem to remain there forever. The word Shem here and earlier, as in the opening verses of chapter 6 of Genesis, is commonly translated to name. As far back as in my first book, The 12th Planet, I have suggested that the term originally and in the relevant context referred to what the Egyptians called the celestial boat and the Sumerians called Mu, the skyship of the gods. Accordingly, the temple in Jerusalem, built atop the stone platform with the Ark of the Covenant placed upon the sacred rock, was to serve as an earthly bond with a celestial deity, both for communicating and for the landing of its skyship. Right, exactly. It's a power supply for a stargate. I absolutely believe that's what it is. That is exactly why, and this is what none of the moon researchers who you get into the fake moon landing stuff can wrap their minds around. That's exactly the real reason why they faked the moon landing and created the whole moon race in the first place. It's because it talks about in these Sumerian texts, we talked about it in the Lost Book of Enki, that I think it was Enki and, what was his one of his sons. They went to a moon for a period of time, and they took with them the power supply for the bond with heaven and earth, the power supply for the Stargate. And so I think after years and years of finally having a context for what these texts talked about, they realized that they had been looking all over Earth for the Ark of the Covenant all these years, and in reality, the Ark of the Covenant is on the moon. Now, the Templars at one time had possession of the Ark of the Covenant. And after, they were decried as being, being into black magic and all that stuff and were burned at the stake and all that good nastiness, the rest fled with the rest of the information they had gotten from excavating Solomon's Temple, and they went to Edinburgh, Scotland, set up Freemasonry. And while they allegedly were on the moon, which we know was shot in a studio, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin performed a Masonic ritual in which they declared the moon to be the property of World International Freemasonry. Meaning that whatever is found or brought up there later, subsequently by anyone, can be challenged by the Freemasons and by the people who really want to get the Ark of the Covenant back for the Templars, the modern-day Freemasons. Because their mission was to ensure that nobody else got the power supply before the United States. Do they have it now? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think they can. I think they're going to try to send, robots and stuff up there to retrieve it. But yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. Throughout the temple, there was no statue, no idol, no graven image. The only object within it was the hallowed Ark of the Covenant. And there was nothing in the Ark except the two tablets that were given to Moses in Sinai. Unlike the Mesopotamian ziggurat temples from Enlil's Nippur to Marduk's in Babylon, this one was not a place of residence for the deity where the god lived, ate, slept, and bathed. It was a house of worship, a place of divine contact. It was a temple for a divine presence by the dweller in the clouds. It is said that a picture is worth a thousand words. It is certainly true where there are few pertinent words, but many relevant pictures. It was about the time that Jerusalem Temple was completed and consecrated to the dweller in the clouds that a noticeable change in the sacred glyptic, the depiction of the divine, took place, where such depictions were common and permissible, and at the time, first and foremost, in Assyria, they showed most clearly the god Ashur as a dweller of the clouds. Full face or with just his hand showing, frequently depicted holding a bow, a depiction reminding one of the Bible's tale of the bow and the cloud that was a divine sign in the aftermath of the deluge. A century or so later, Assyrian depictions introduced a new variant of the god in the cloud, classified as deity in a winged disc. They clearly showed a deity inside the emblem of a winged disc, by itself or as it joins the earth and the moon. Since the winged disc represents Nibiru, it had to be a deity arriving with Nibiru. Well, I think it also could just be representatory of a ship. A spaceship itself is what I think it is. It's representing the person coming down in a spaceship, not absolutely has to be Nibiru. I hate that when you say it absolutely has to be this. You know, when you're demanding that it's, you know, it absolutely has to be this. No, I don't agree with that. And see, that's a bully type stuff right there. I don't agree with that. I think it could just as well be a ship, not, you know, I mean, he just constantly, that's the thing that that is the biggest op to me about Sitchin, just constantly tries to hammer home that planet thing to you. The changes in glyphs and symbols begun with the sign of the cross were manifestations of more profound expectations of overwhelming changes and wider preparations called for by the expected return. However, the expectations and preparations were not the same in Babylon as in Assyria. In one of the messianic expectations were centered on the gods who were already there, in other, the expectations related to the gods about to return and reappear. In Babylon, the expectations were mostly a messianic revival by Marduk through his son Nabu. Great efforts were undertaken to resume, circa 960 BCE, the sacred Akitu ceremonies, in which the revised Enuma Elish, appropriating to Marduk the creation of earth, the reshaping of the heavens, the solar system, and the fashioning of man, was publicly read. The arrival of Nabu from the shrine in Borsippa, just south of Babylon, to play a crucial role in the ceremonies was an essential part of the revival. Accordingly, the Babylonian kings who reigned between 900 BCE and 730 BCE resumed bearing Marduk-related names, and in great numbers Nabu-related names. The changes in Assyria were more geopolitical, historians consider. The time circa 960 BCE is the start of the Neo-Assyrian imperial period. In addition to inscriptions on monuments and palace walls, the main source of information about Assyria in those days is the annals of its kings, in which they recorded what they did year by year. Judging by that, their main occupation was conquest. With unparalleled ferocity, its kings set out on a military campaign, one after another, not only to have dominion over the olden Sumer and Akkad, but also over what they deemed essential for the return, control of the space-related sites. That this was the purpose of the campaigns is evident not only from their targets, but also from the grand stone reliefs. Now, see, again, he contradicts himself. If everything revolves around having control of the spaceports, and I would agree with that from my research, I think that's definitely something to that. That's why there's importance put around these biblical cities, because it's like whoever, whatever the people are that are around these cities where the landing pads are going to be considered, you know, the chosen people or whatever. And so that indicates that there are ships returning and landing on Earth, and that, you know, these have importance. But that, to me, contradicts the idea that, you know, it's that this is always this planet coming around, Nibiru. You see? So that's another case there where, I mean, I don't know how anybody who doesn't have a brain can't see that. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But again, this stuff kind of preys on you being ignorant, you know, and not researching this stuff yourself. Interestingly, their first target was the area of Khabur River with its important trade and religious center, Haran. Their successors took it from there, frequently bearing the name as previously glorified kings, hence the numerations 1, 2, 3, etc. For them, the successive kings expanded Assyrian control in all directions, but with special emphasis on the coastal cities and mountains of Laban, Lebanon, circa 860 BCE. Ashurbanipal II who wore the cross symbol on his chest, boasted of capturing the Phoenician coastal cities of Tyre, Sidon, and Gebel, and of ascending the Cedar Mountain with its sacred site, the olden landing place of the Anunnaki. His son and successor, Shalmaneser III, recorded the erecting there of a commemorative stela, calling the place Bit Adini. The name literally meant the Eden abode, and was known by that same name to the biblical prophets. The prophet Ezekiel castigated the king of Tyre for deeming himself a god because he had been to that sacred place and moved within its fiery stones. And the prophet Amos listed when he spoke of the coming day of the Lord. As could be expected, the Assyrians then turned their attention to the other space-related site. After the death of Solomon, his kingdom was split by his contending heirs into Judea, with Jerusalem as its capital in the south and Israel as its 10 tribes in the north. In his best-known inscribed monument, the Black Obelisk, Shalmaneser III recorded the receipt of tribute from the Israelite king Jehu, and in a scene dominated by the winged disc emblem of Nibiru, depicted him kneeling in obeisance. Both the Bible and the Assyrian annals recorded the subsequent invasion of Israel by Tiglath-Pileser III, the detaching of its better provinces, and the partial exile of the leaders. Then, in 1722 BCE, his son Shalmaneser V overran what was left of Israel, exiled all of its people, and replaced them with foreigners. The 10 tribes were gone, their whereabouts remaining a lasting mystery. Why and how, on his return from Israel, Shalmaneser was punished and abruptly replaced on the throne by another son of Tiglath-Pileser is also an unsolved mystery. Well, it's not an unsolved mystery to me. It's a classic case of them assassinating somebody else and putting somebody else with the power structure wants in a position of power. That's all that is. Having already captured the landing place, the Assyrians were now at the doorstep of the final prize, Jerusalem. But again, they held off the final assault. The Bible explained it by attributing it all to the will of Yahweh. An examination of Assyrian records suggests that what and when they did in Israel and Judea was synchronized with what and when they did about Babylon and Marduk. After the capture of the space-related site in Lebanon, but before launching the campaigns towards Jerusalem, the Assyrians took an unprecedented step for reconciliation with Marduk. In 729 BCE, Tiglath-Pileser III entered Babylon, went to its sacred precinct, and took the hands of Marduk. It was a gesture with great religious and diplomatic significance. The priests of Marduk approved the reconciliation by inviting Tiglath-Pileser to share in the god's sacramental meal. Following that, Tiglath-Pileser's son Sargon II marched southward in the olden Sumer and Akkad areas, and after seizing Nippur, turned back again to Babylon. In 710 BCE, he, like his father, took the hands of Marduk during the New Year ceremonies. The task of capturing the remaining space-related site fell to Sargon's successor, Sennacherib. The assault on Jerusalem in 704 BCE at the time of its king Hezekiah is amply recorded both in Sennacherib's annals and in the Bible. But while Sennacherib, in his inscriptions spoke just of the successful seizing of Judean provincial cities, the Bible provides a detailed tale of the siege of Jerusalem by a mighty Assyrian army that was miraculously wiped out by Yahweh's will. Encircling Jerusalem and entrapping its people, the Assyrians engaged in psychological warfare by shouting discouraging words to the defenders on the city's walls, ending with vilification of Yahweh. The shocked king Hezekiah tore his clothes in mourning and prayed in the temple to Yahweh, the God of Israel, who rests upon the cherubim, the sole God upon all the nations, for help. In response, the prophet Isaiah conveyed to him God's oracle. The Assyrian king shall never enter the city. He will return home in failure, and there he will be assassinated. And it came to pass that night that the angel of Yahweh went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And at sunrise, lo and behold, they were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, departed and journeyed back to his abode in Nineveh. And that's in 2 Kings 1935-36. It's just incredible to you know, when you have the context for what Nineveh and all this stuff means, and you see that in the Bible, you're like, my God, you know, the Bible's all about, you know, aliens and invaders and all this. It's just insane. To make sure the reader realizes that the whole prophecy came true, the biblical narrative then continues. And Sennacherib went away and journeyed back to Nineveh. And it was when he was bowing down in his temple to his God that Adramelech and Shazir struck him down with a sword. And they fled to the land of the Arat. His son Ereshkigal became king in his stead. The biblical postscript is an amazingly informed record. Sennacherib was indeed murdered by his own sons in 681 BCE for the second time. Assyrian kings who attacked Israel or Judea were dead as soon as they went back. While prophecy, the foretelling of what is yet to happen, is inherently what is expected of a prophet, the prophets of the Hebrew Bible were more than that. From the very beginning, as was made clear in Leviticus, a prophet was not to be a magician, a wizard, an enchanter, a charmer, or a seer of spirits, a fortune teller, or one who conjures the dead. A pretty comprehensive list of the varied fortune tellers of the surrounding nations. Their mission as Nabiya, spokesman, was to convey to kings and peoples Yahweh's own words. And as Hezekiah's prayer made clear, while the children of Israel were his chosen people, he was sole God upon all the nations. The Bible speaks of prophets from Moses on, but only 15 of them have their own books in the Bible. They include the three majors, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, and 12 minors. Their prophetic period began with Amos in Judea and Hosea in Israel and ended with Malachi circa 450 BCE. As expectations of the return took shape, geopolitics combined to serve as the foundation of biblical prophecy. And so we'll stop right there for tonight. But, you know, that's been the whole thing. You know, we've been sold this line. Remember, you know, the people who sell atheism are the same people who sell, blind following of religion. It's being created by the same people. The context is what we've been missing. You know, people always say, oh, you know, the Bible's bullshit, or these ancient texts are bullshit or whatever. Well, no, it's bullshit if you don't have the context. Once you start to understand what they're really talking about, it all makes sense. So, yeah, unbelievable stuff there. Continues to be more and more revealing the more that we read, and hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. Boy, I tell you what, still learning and still getting a new context every day. That's what it's all about. Always searching for that newer context to further our research and our own enlightenment on down the road. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. Please use the chip-in banner, the donate button, or the P.O. box to support our work, because we rely on our listeners here, and we're here because of you, and I'm here because of you, and we don't have commercials and sponsors and any outside funding, and in order to continue, we just need help with cash, and we can use whatever we can get right now, big or small. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. We'll see you tomorrow for the broadcast. You guys have a great one. Take care.